Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome. Well, we have two very different topics for you today, so I wanted to start the show by asking you some questions. I want to know, have you ever been criticized for simply being you? Have you ever adapted your personality to fit in with your coworkers or a boss, or compromised your values and beliefs? Have you ever gone along to get along? And Eric's nodding his head there, and I know that, you know, I've done the same too. Well, in the first segment today, we are exploring personality types at work and in relationships, and how you can make a difference just by being you. Now, another question. Have you ever thought, no matter how secretly, fess up now, have you ever thought, one day I'd like to write a novel? And again, Eric's nodding his head. I know he's working on something. Well, now's your chance because November is National Novel Writing Month. Later in the show, we'll be talking with Chris Beatty. He's the founder of National Novel Writing Month. It's become a worldwide event, and Chris is joining us to share how you can participate and write that novel now. First, let me welcome Gregory Husko to the show. He's an organizational psychologist with more than 30 years' experience as an award-winning educator, researcher, and consultant. He focuses on organizational change, teams, personalities, and leadership. He's worked with Ford Motor Company, Kellogg, British Petroleum, to name a few, and is currently a professor in the master's program at Eastern Michigan University. He's written four highly acclaimed books, and his latest shows you how to use your personality to make a difference at work and in your relationship, and it's called appropriately enough, Making a Difference by Being Yourself. Gregory Husko, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vicki. I look forward to us talking.
Yeah, I wanted to begin with just a little bit about you, let our listeners know who you are and where you've been. And I know that you began college thinking you'd become a basketball and a math teacher.
I thought that was the ultimate.
So how did you end up becoming an organizational psychologist?
Well, to make a long story short, I got a little bit sick and tired of school at one point and took a job at Dodge Truck, Warren Truck Assembly in the Detroit area. And I ended up getting fired four times in 5 months.
Oh.
Yeah. The first two weren't my fault, but people say that all the time anyway. But I'm a lucky guy. I landed on my feet, and it really got me very interested in work teams as opposed to sports teams and why not involve people that are doing the work and taking a look at how to improve the work. And the more that you could get collaboration and the more people could work together, the more could happen. More things the organization could benefit from, and the more things the individual worker could as well. So I'm a lucky guy. I went back to school, switched over to industrial organizational psychology, and have been a guy that's never been bored with my work life ever since.
What is it about teams that fascinates you so much?
Well, you know, to some extent, I always wonder why a group of individuals, especially a group of talented individuals, don't always mesh well together as a team. I've been sort of curious about the chemistry of teams, if you will. And so what I did was, through my consulting practice, no matter what other kind of work I was doing, I asked if I could interview the group or team within the organization that that was thought to be the highest performing and most successful team. And after a couple of years of interviews, I started noticing some common themes across these groups. And from there, I developed a questionnaire and then gathered data from hundreds of teams. And sure enough, I found seven key ingredients that separates the great teams from the so-so teams.
Mm-hmm. Give us a couple of those ingredients.
Well, first and foremost, a clear sense of direction. The idea that we know what our goals are and we know the purpose of why this team exists. I don't know if you've ever been on a committee that halfway through the committee's life, somebody in the group says, hey, what are we supposed to be doing anyway? And it's such a frustrating thing. It happens again and again in organizations. So the clearer we are focused on the purpose and the goals, the more likely we've got a shot at becoming a good team. A couple of the other things are we can't always all be collectively responsible for everything. I mean, we have to understand each individual's role on a team and fulfill those individual roles and responsibilities in addition to working collectively to accomplish the goals. And just to quickly rattle off the others, so you got to have talent, you got to have clear procedures, you got to have constructive interpersonal relationships, there's got to be some reward for being team-oriented, and finally, the best teams not only get their own act together, but they purposely develop good external relations with the rest of the organization.
Now, if only everybody knew that when they put a team together, we wouldn't have half the problems.
That could be a good step forward, but there's never a perfect team either, so it's always a matter of continuous improvement.
Mm. So there are a lot of books out there on personality, and many of us have heard of the Briggs-Myers tests and several other personality tests, especially if you worked in the corporate world. You know, for a few years, you've probably had all of them done on you at one point. What made you want to write this book, and how do you think this book differs from other books out there?
Well, a couple of reasons. First and foremost, you know, I've gone through and facilitated lots of Myers-Briggs workshops, and it sort of frustrates me at the end that at the most, people try to just remember their letters or just try to figure out what box they're in or resent that they're feeling like they've been pigeonholed. And the purpose of it isn't to identify type per se. It's to figure out how to use your personality. And so I wanted to investigate not a way to identify personalities, but rather to identify how to use the wonderful natural gifts that are associated with each personality type. So one of the driving forces was to figure out how to make use of personality as opposed to just know what it is. And the other side of it is the whole notion of making a difference. I don't know, Vicki, if you've ever been found guilty of this, but I have, of trying to be a perfectionist.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes my perfectionism, you know, I used to think that was sort of cool. It would push me to try harder and encourage me to try to put my standards very high. But I didn't realize how I oftentimes then just inhibited myself from getting involved or from trying things instead of making that incremental difference or that next step forward of making a difference. I would let my perfectionism get in the way. And
right.
So I find making a difference is a healthy alternative to perfectionism.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people want that intrinsic feeling that they are making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking of making a difference, you're not necessarily talking, you know, go out and do something monumental like
Mother Teresa.
Mm-hmm. You're talking like, you know, helping elderly neighbors, mentoring a coworker, making a difference in every day-to-day life, right?
Exactly, yeah. You can think globally, but you got to act locally, as the old slogan goes or whatever. And, you know, if we're thinking that we always have to either rely on leaders to change the world or feel totally helpless ourselves, we're not going to be very happy campers. So this book isn't about the Warren Buffetts or the Abraham Lincolns or the Rosa Parks. It's about the ordinary people. And as you may know, I interviewed 500 people and asked them to tell me three stories each. Time they made a difference at work, a time they made a difference in a relationship, and a time they made a difference in their community. And lo and behold, all 500 could tell me all three stories.
Mm.
And then as part of the study, I already had their Myers-Briggs type results. And so we reviewed all the stories blind to type, and sure enough, different themes emerged for different personality types. So different personalities make a difference differently.
Well, I took the test again.
Oh, did you?
I have taken it a couple of times throughout my life, and
okay.
I took it again. So in a little while, I want to ask you how I can make a difference using my personality type. But I wanted to, you say there are four core personalities. How does knowing our personality type help us make a difference?
Well, I found that there's some natural gifts, if you will, associated with each of these core types. Should I go over the four types?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. The first type is I'll call the stabilizers. If you're familiar with Myers-Briggs lingo, all of these refer to the middle two letters of the Myers-Briggs code, if you will. And so they're the ST types, the stabilizers. These folks are great. They're just very practical, matter-of-fact, down-to-earth folks. They love to see themselves as having common sense and think the whole world would be a heck of a lot better if we just used more common sense. The real step-by-step sort of people. They like to use tried and true methods. They're really into details and logic. So those stabilizers are very dependable stabilizing types that exist in work and exist in relationships as well. Then the harmonizer types, they're the folks that are really kind of the classic people. You know, they don't have to memorize stuff about people. You tell them something about you and it just sort of sticks in their brain. And they're not too fond of conflict. They'd rather have everyone happy. They make their decisions based more on the moment, and they're great at helping people feel like they're included, like one big happy family. They'll notice, you know, somebody's hanging back, and they'll introduce people to other people and be very respectful and civil and get people involved. So they tend to be very considerate types, very golden rule types. They're kind of the hosts and hostesses of the world. The third type is the catalyst, the NF and the Myers-Briggs framework. Very enthusiastic types. I mean, these people just want to discover the meaning of life. They're into possibilities and into insight, and they really believe in causes, especially people-oriented causes. And so they're the kind of folks that say, come on, together we can do this. We can make a big difference. And they tend to have a great gift for communicating that in a passionate sort of way. So they're energized by causes and pulling people together. They tend to see the good in all people, though you can prove yourself to be no good to an NF. they start out with the assumption there's good in all, and they want things to be enjoyable and meaningful. And finally, there's the NT visionaries. The visionaries are folks that immediately try to figure out how stuff fits together. They look at the interrelationship of possibilities in a somewhat impersonal sort of way. They challenge themselves and others, big for achievement. They're very confident and blunt. They want to be the architects of the future. They tend to be a bit more theoretical and systems sort of thinkers and very goal and future oriented. They've got very high standards for themselves as well as for others. So they help by kind of building the system for the future. And each of these four that I just described, Vicki, have different ways of making a difference.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll take a look at how each of those categories can make a difference in the world today. You're
Perfect.
Listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest is Gregory Husko. His new book is called Making a Difference by Being Yourself, Using Your Personality Type at Work and in Relationships. Stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Does the rat race get you down?
Would you like to opt out or shake things up? Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on the third Monday of every month to hear about alternative lifestyles and viable career options. Coming November 17th, learn what it takes to build a profitable freelance lifestyle with longtime freelancer Michelle Goodman. Hear about the ups and downs, how you can create your own work hours, how to build a solid reputation, and what you should consider before quitting your day job. Michelle Goodman is a Seattle-based expert who's learned firsthand how to support herself while building a successful freelance business. Join us for Get a Freelance Life, coming Monday, November 17th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
The search is over. You found the station that's not afraid to be different. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. We are talking today with Gregory Husko. He's an organizational psychologist and author, and his book is called Making a Difference by Being Yourself. We're often told we have to change to fit in. Gregory says, no, we can make a difference by being ourselves. So, Gregory, before the break, we looked at the four core personality types.
Mm-hmm.
Which are stabilizers, harmonizers, catalysts, and visionaries.
Yeah.
How can each of these make a difference?
Okay.
By being themselves? And, you know, I have to say the one of the things I really like about your work is that you do say focus on your strengths, because so often we're told, you know, you have to improve on your weak areas.
You say
focus on your strengths.
That's right. And some of those weak areas we're never going to be great at. We just need to be good enough to make sure that we don't make catastrophic errors. But the way we're going to contribute to organizations and to our relationships is by consciously using our strengths. And we can't just take them for granted. We don't have to brag about them. We just have to consciously think about ways of building into our lives the way our strengths are and how we can use those at work and in relationships. You know, you mentioned the four types. Let's look at them in reverse order this time. Let's start with those NTs, those visionary types.
Okay.
You know, the way they help out at work is to really push for the big picture. You know, they want to know, how's this stuff fit in? They don't want to know, you know, what's the next task to do. They want to know what's the next several tasks and how do those tasks relate to each other. And they make a difference by using their strengths, in particular, their competencies, to solve problems and to help with planning. So people that are good at really being systematic problem solvers and kind of strategic planners oftentimes are that NT type at work that helps us kind of see the bigger picture, if you've seen people like that. And in relationships, it's interesting, those NT types tend to be the same sort of strengths but apply to relationships. So they sometimes come across as a little more impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you remember the Star Trek series with Mr. Spock?
Right.
Yeah. He'd be an over-exaggerated MT or whatever. But, you know, you watched a few episodes, and you knew he had a heart of gold. But he had to logically figure everything out, you know,
right.
Even his values. And so he was good at using his logic to help people make plans and to solve problems. And the way he helped relationships on the Starship Enterprise there is by using his logic and problem-solving. So NTs don't have to do things in a kind of warm and fuzzy way to make a difference in a relationship. They can do it, again, by being themselves. I remember one story I heard from an NT where they were so fond of being competent and very fond of this woman that they were engaged to, and he recognized that he wasn't a very good listener. So he read a book about listening and then just systematically learned how to be a better listener and just made sure that he was competent at that particular skill because he could logically see how it would make a difference in his relationship with his loved one. So he was terrific at making that happen. On a work front, I remember talking with a young woman that actually was the person that invented the system of how to make credit cards available in China. And so she really thought through the whole banking system. I mean, she was a real big picture and future-oriented person. So anyway, those NTs are interesting characters that do things a bit impersonally but can make a big difference by pulling things together.
Yeah, it's interesting because I used to be a very strong NT.
Is that
and
right?
That was always an issue. People don't see you as approachable. But I like I said, since I took this, I find I've changed a little. Anyway, carry on. I didn't mean to digress.
That's quite right. In fact, it's interesting. NT women sometimes have a more difficult time because that's not the typical image of women in our society or whatever. And so they still need to be themselves. They just need to be able to utilize their natural strengths to pull things together in a relationship.
Mm.
Well, the NF types, those catalyst types, they're the spark plugs. You know, they have all that energy, and they inspire people at their best to contribute their strengths to an organization. And, you know, they're the kind of people, Vicki, that has to, like, care about the company they work for. You know, they can't just work for any old company. They'd much rather believe in the cause, you know.
So right.
They may believe in healthcare, so they got to work for a hospital system, or they may want to make sure that the ethics of that company are particularly strong and positive because, you know, they're just not going to work for a company just for the sake of having a job, or at least they won't feel very fulfilled that way. And in relationships, they're wonderful at encouraging growth and insight. They're to be honest, suckers for insight. They just love those aha phenomenon, both for themselves and to help others get that. And they're very exciting people to meet and have relationships with. Because their energy and their enthusiasm is so catchy. So the NFs oftentimes make a difference in those sorts of ways. You know, I knew one NF in my sample that taught creativity. creativity to a bunch of folks that didn't think of themselves as very creative, you know, a bunch of engineers and accountants that were working for this particular company. And she just inspired, you know, she learned this this program on creativity, and she made it fun, and she got them enthused and got them excited about adding their creativity to the work of they were doing in that company. I knew another NF that he made a difference recognizing his own problems with alcohol and getting involved in AA and eventually working up the courage to be able to speak at meetings and eventually feeling like he made a difference because he was willing to stand up in front of a group of people that were struggling with their disease and help them feel that there is a way and that they can move forward.
Mm, they're appropriately named the catalyst. Very appropriate, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? They can be those spark plugs for change.
Mm.
So the harmonizer type, those folks, again, are very people-oriented, but kind of in a more down-to-earth, and they make a difference by making work, even impersonal tasks, feel more people-oriented, you know. So they're the folks that make sure that we have a holiday party or that the group gets together after work every once in a while or that the work setting itself is really comfortable. I remember one SF or a harmonizer that I interviewed, her big thing was that she figured out ways to make headsets more comfortable because people were wearing, and she worried about them feeling like their ears were being pinched all day long, you know. I mean, doesn't sound like a big deal, but boy, those people were much happier as a result of
I was going to say, I laugh, but that's a pretty critical thing if you've got headset on all day.
I bet, yeah. So those SFs and relationships, you know, boy, they just have that warm-hearted, caring nature. You know, they help people feel they're valued and supportive, tend not to be very judgmental, at least at first. Once you find out the other person's values, they may get upset, but in general, they're just very caring types. I remember interviewing one who went to her friend's grandfather's funeral because her friend was out of the country at the time, and she just wanted her friend to be represented at her grandfather's funeral or whatever. So they make sacrifices. They'll run errands for people. They'll send cards and flowers and birthday cards on employee birthday days and personal birthday days as well. So those harmonizers are those warm types that help everyone feel included and feel valued.
Mm.
And then finally, those stabilizer types, they're, like I said, real down-to-earth types. They break down these complex issues into a series of steps, and they make sure that we just understand, we just do this step next, and then that next, and eventually we get some practical results. And so they make a difference at work by simplifying things and by being dependable and by providing, you know, really task-oriented training. One simple example I remember hearing from a ST type was he worked for an Indy car company, and they always had their pit crews having itineraries of where to be for which part of the race and which part of the days preceding the race and whatnot, and these guys were always losing their itineraries and getting mixed up. So he just simply simplified the form for their itinerary and laminated it and put it around their neck.
These guys were always
on time and always knew where to go after that, you know.
Again, yeah. It doesn't take a lot to make a difference, does
that's
it?
That's exactly right. I mean, and it just fit this guy's personality perfectly. He just took what was a frustrating situation and simplified it and made it good for everyone. Now, these same types, you know, use this matter-of-fact approach to help people in emotional situations, too. They oftentimes have a real dependable, calm manner, kind of lowering the stress or maybe not even recognizing the emotions of the moment, but helping people get through those kinds of difficult times. Again, a simple example of one of the ST stabilizers that I interviewed just noticed that his neighbor was going through a grieving period of a loved one dying. And this guy just went over and cut the guy's grass while he was at the funeral home and whatnot and just took care of making sure the outside looked nice so this guy didn't have to worry about that stuff when he came home to his home and figured the guy would feel pretty lonely with his anyway. So, you know, again, a very simple thing, but something that really made a difference.
Right. What type are you, Greg?
Well, I must admit I'm an NT. My full Myers-Briggs type would be a INTP. So I'm one of the visionary types. And I'm married to a wonderful SF harmonizer. And so we've been able to celebrate our differences. And in fact, your area made a difference for us. That's where we had our honeymoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from Vancouver and Portland and Seattle, all through that area there. She was born and raised up that way originally.
So do you think on the whole, I mean, it's kind of hard to say, but on the whole, do you find that, I remember when I first took this and then I was a very strong, what was I, NT. And somebody said, well, you must be married to a total opposite. And I said, no, I'm married to a very strong NT.
A what?
do opposites attract, or do
well? It's interesting you bring that up. You know what we do know is there. Well, I don't know if this is bad news or not, but there can be conflict in both similar types and different type mixtures in a couple. But it's a different kind of conflict. So similar types, they'll more instantly understand each other. You know, it's easier to understand somebody that's similar to you, but you may compete for the same goodies, if you will. You know. So two NTs are sometimes very competitive in terms of who's more competent and who can handle what. So as long as they can work that out together, they can solve all kinds of life's problems. But if they don't watch it, they could be pretty competitive types. We're somebody married to a complete opposite. The key there is really understanding and not discounting, actually celebrating the other person's talent, recognizing together, you know, we lessen the number of blind spots we have.
Yeah,
I can count on you to make sure that we have our, I can count on my wife, for instance, to make sure that we have a great gathering with the neighbors and that our social life is terrific and that she makes our household so warm and friendly. And she can count on me to make sure that, you know, we'll think through what we've got to do for our family budget and what we need to do to be able to be in the house we want to be in and, you know, some of the other sorts of things that she could easily discount as just impersonal sorts of things, but she doesn't. She celebrates that, and I try to celebrate her great strengths too.
Yeah, let me tell you one of the issues I have with this when corporations do it as a whole is that people tend to categorize you and say, oh, well, you're that way because, you know, you're one of those.
Exactly.
How do you cope with that kind of situation? Mm. Because I think it can be very detrimental.
It sure can, and unfortunately, as you've described, too often those sessions deteriorate into that sort of excuse making and pigeonholing people. I mean, first of all, as you probably know, we actually all are mixtures of all of these types. What we're really discovering is what our natural preferences are, not what we're permanently like. Are you left-handed or right-handed?
Right-handed.
Right-handed. Now, if you were to try to sign your name using your left hand, you could, but it probably would not come across as well-developed and feel awkward to do and whatnot. So you have these other personality types within you. It's just one of those type combinations is a more naturally you. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes in these sessions, we really need to facilitate them in a manner that recognizes that you know, we're here to make sure that we can capitalize on the differences, not compete to see whose type is better and whose blind sides are easier to ridicule.
Mm. And I remember also taking this, it was actually a different test, but very similar. There are certain people that you know, if they kind of generally fall into that category, you have to be a little bit more gentle with or just very bottom line with.
Good point.
I think that's kind of helpful. So
yeah, it helps you get some strategies of how to approach people that are different than you.
Yeah.
And, you know, their ideas are very valuable too, but the idea may get lost in the style. And so sometimes we need to modify our own style and try to keep to the same message, but present it in a way that gets across to a person of a personality type different than us. So if you're a very detailed person, you need to be able to pull things together a little bit for those that are more big pictured. And likewise, on the flip side, those people that are big picture folks need to come up with some concrete examples to get their ideas supported and across to folks that are more detailed.
Yeah, and I, being a big picture visual kind of person, always make sure my right-hand person is very detailed.
All right.
But then I sometimes forget to share the details that I need them to take care of.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're not perfect.
Far from.
Yeah, well, but you make a difference, right?
I hope so.
I bet you do.
I want to ask you about the full Myers-Briggs. I told you that I did take it and was going to share that. I was an EN, but then I fell into the last two categories were very kind of wishy-washy. Mm. Why does that happen?
Well,
to me, it looked like, well, in that circumstance, I'd be this way. In another circumstance, mm-hmm. I'd be that way.
You know, again, both you are both a thinker and a feeler. One of them is a little bit more naturally you. Why your scores were too close to call the second time, I don't know you, so I don't know how to speculate why. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could have been some things going on with you at the time. It could have been how you answered the questions. You know, sometimes the instructions really on the Myers-Briggs are to answer them as your real true self, not just how you behave, because, you know, situations drive behaviors as much or more so, actually, than personalities. I mean, we act different in church than we act at a bar, or we act different in a social setting than we do at a staff meeting, perhaps.
Right.
Some people don't, but overall, they should anyway. So situations drive behaviors, and if the situations were ripe in your mind, that may have driven you to answer some of the questions in a manner consistent with what your recent situations were.
What are the most common personalities in America? What are the least common?
Okay, yeah. The most common are the SF and STs. This society is very much dominated by the sensing types, the detailed types, the matter-of-fact types or whatever. And there's some controversy whether there's more harmonizers or more stabilizers, but clearly those two types are much more of the population. Our latest guess would be about 43% of the U.S. population is more of the harmonizer type.
Wow.
And maybe about 30% the stabilizer type. But if you're out there in NTNF land, catalysts and visionaries, much rarer personalities. The visionary type's probably about 10% of the population, and the catalyst type about 16-17% of the population.
Wow, that's interesting. Do you find that you act differently at work than you do in relationships?
Well, certainly to an extent. I see a core part of me continue on in both, but clearly, I as everyone else, reacts to the situation. And so it's not like I try to be somebody different. It's just I have different expectations to fulfill. And so I need to be a little more proper in my work situations than I ordinarily am. So if you compared me to the other professors in my department, probably people would say that Greg's a little less prone towards proper behavior than the rest of them.
Well, tell us how.
I shouldn't condemn myself too much, but anyway, so relatively speaking, your personality shows up in both. It just the situation will shape how that looks. To a large extent.
So I was looking through the research, the material that your uh-huh. publicist had sent out, and she had a question on there, and I'm going to ask that one. Whose personality is more likely to make a difference, Obama's or McCain's?
Oh, boy.
And yeah. How would you know that?
Well, you know, what I think, it's the one who's going to use their the strengths of their personality more, not the one who tries to be all things to all people. Although I have my favorite, they both have strengths. And I think the one that really makes use of their strengths to help lead this country, and, by the way, the one that surrounds themselves with people probably different than themselves to make sure that they've got a well-rounded view and a well-rounded set of strategies and tactics to help us through our difficult times. That's the one that's going to make the biggest difference for us.
Mm. And quickly, because we're kind of running out of time now, if I were putting a team together, if somebody's out there listening, putting a team together, how do they? What are some key tips that they need to keep in mind when they're pulling that team together?
Okay. First and foremost, really clarify what the purpose of the team is. You know, why does this team exist? What is it supposed to accomplish? Second, when picking people for the team, I would not pick them because of their personality. I'd pick them because of their skills, you know, to figure out what knowledge, what skills are necessary to get the job done, and then make sure that once the talent is on the team, the ability then for different personality types to work with each other training and opportunities to learn about each other is provided so that they can get along sufficiently. And then finally, that the best teams don't wing it. The best teams have a kind of set of procedures that they operate as a team. And so making clear what those procedures are, hopefully involving the team in identifying those procedures, but making sure there's a bit of a discipline to how we operate as a team, that's what's going to make a difference.
Sounds good. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Gregory?
Well, I'd love to challenge all of us to just think about ways that we spend our time. You know, we need to live our lives consciously, and sure, it's good to just take it easy and kill some time from time to time, but let's make a habit of making a difference. And maybe each week, kind of at least pick something at our work situation and something in a relationship where we'd like to make a difference. Not make a difference to change another person, but make a difference to make that relationship better or to make the work setting a little more satisfying or a little more effective. So we can all do it if we all just took a little time each week to make a difference.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Now, I didn't find a website for you. Do you have one?
Yes, so it's temporarily down. It's going to be up in another week again. It is www.makingadifferencetype, all one large letter, or word rather, makingadifferencetype.com.
Okay, makingadifferencetype.com.
Correct.
Thank you, Greg, for being with us.
Well, hey, my pleasure.
Yeah, great information.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I guess, of course, Gregory Huska. I'm going to spell his name for you because it's kind of unusual. It's HUSZCZO. Gregory Husko and his book, Making a Difference by Being Yourself, Using Your Personality Type at Work and in Relationships. And stay with us when we come back. We'll be talking to Chris Beatty about National Novel Writing Month and how you can get involved if you've ever thought you want to write a novel. You're listening to Conversations Live.
Looking for new fiction authors or a different kind of book for good writing that challenges the mind, the heart, the spirit? Then check out Book Talk Podcasting at 1150kknw.com. Book Talk brings you weekly bite-sized book reviews brought to you by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. You can listen to Book Talk Podcasts at 1150kknw.com or anytime by downloading them to your MP3 player. If you'd like to try your hand at submitting a review, email info@conversationslive.net for more information. To listen to Book Talk, go to 1150kknw.com and click on podcasting. It's that simple.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit PAWS.org or 425-787-2500. PAWS.org or 425-787-2500.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's The Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss The Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
No other station brings you this much variety. Welcome to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, welcome back. Do you have a novel in you just waiting to burst out? Have you ever secretly dreamed about becoming a novelist? Well, about 9 years ago, Chris Beatty got together with a group of friends and formed a writing group. That group has since grown to become a worldwide event known as National Novel Writing Month. And Chris is here today to share how you can participate and get that novel out of your head and onto the paper. Chris, welcome.
It's great to be here, Vicky. Thank you so much.
Sure. And I want to just say how this got started. I read you got together with a bunch of over-caffeinated friends, and what happened?
Yeah, well, it really was kind of one of those crazy ideas that probably shouldn't have ever really taken place. But I just sort of proposed this idea to a group of friends of mine, and we weren't really aspiring fiction writers. I think we were more book lovers rather than book writers. And but we ended up just kind of setting this word count goal of 50,000 words and set a timeline of a month. And we kind of got together every night after work and wrote, and the books kind of came alive. And the whole process ended up being so much more fun than I had ever thought it would be. And the books were definitely bad, but they weren't atrociously irredeemably bad. And for me, that seemed like a pretty big sign of success. So it's just kind of grown from there. And that was just kind of friends the first year and then friends of friends the next year. And it's just really spread via word of mouth.
And just to let our listeners know, you started this in 1999, 21 participants,
yeah,
and six winners. Now, by winner, you mean that somebody actually completed the 50,000, right? There's no prize, per se, other than the completing the 50,000 words.
Exactly. Our winners get a wonderful, or I should say wonderfully mediocre, array of prizes that include a PDF of a winner certificate and your name on the winner's page. But ultimately, what you get is the manuscript itself.
Right. But you go from 21 participants and six winners in 1999. In 2007, you had 101,510 participants and 15,333 winners. And this year, it's even higher than that, right?
Right. I think we're probably going to look at 120,000 adults in about 80 countries. And then we have a young writers program as well that's kind of based more in classrooms to get kids and teens excited about fiction writing. And that will probably have about 18,000 participants as well.
Wow. Now, how does somebody get started? I mean, how do they get involved?
Well, you basically just go to our website, which is nanowrimo.org, and you create a free account. We're a nonprofit, so none of this costs anything. And then over the course of the month, you write on your own computer and then sort of log your word count on our site. And there's also all sorts of forums where you can get advice about, you know, what to do if your, you know, if your plot is taking a wrong turn, or you need some more drama, or you need less drama. There's a, you know, world of participants out there that are ready to kind of give advice. And then over the course of the month, you just continue to update your word count, and you get email pep talks from, you know, well-known authors. And it's really just kind of a supportive, encouraging kick in the pants for people who have long thought about writing a book but never have quite gotten around to it.
You know, I actually think it's a really great idea, because I think if people have an idea and they've been tossing it around, if they can just get it down there on paper, that is like the major part of the battle, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think that's where, you know, it seems a little absurd, this idea of writing a novel in a month. And it probably should be called National First Draft of a Novel Writing
right,
Month. Right,
definitely.
Roll off the tongue in the same way. But I think that that's so true, that oftentimes we get so kind of hung up on making it perfect that when you sit down to write and it isn't perfect, which it never is, then you get so discouraged and you kind of you think, okay, I should have no business doing this. But I think when you have that deadline to kind of help keep you moving and sort of ultimately you're breaking this very long journey down into manageable steps, which 50,000 words breaks down into 1,667 words per day, which is really, you can do that. You know, writing a novel is tough, but writing 1,667 words isn't.
Right. Well, we're already at November 3rd now, and so I allowed everyone to have a day off for Thanksgiving or to go vote, whatever. So we'd be looking at like 2,000 words a day now to get it done by the end of the month, which is still very attainable.
It really is. And I think, you know, when I'm talking about this sort of quality notion, that the interesting thing about this is that when you do write for quantity rather than quality, you end up getting both. And I think that there's sort of a counterintuitive logic here, that when you do turn off that inner editor, the one that kind of is second-guessing every sentence you write and telling you that you're a horrible, abysmal excuse for a writer, that somehow you end up kind of tapping into this momentum and this sort of sense of improvisation that you don't really have when you give yourself, you know, 10 years to write the thing.
Right. So how many people have actually been published? How many of your participants have actually been published?
I think at this point we are up to 27 participants have sold their NaNoWriMo manuscripts to publishing houses, like print publishing houses, and then probably five or six times that have sold them as ebooks out in the ebook world.
Wow. That's quite impressive, really. I mean, considering, you know, most, I guess you have professionals and amateurs joining in?
We do, and that's kind of been one of the interesting changes over the years, is it really did start as an event kind of by and for amateurs. I mean, I'm a cultural anthropology major. I didn't really ever study writing, but I definitely always had a real reverence for books. But over the years, I mean, I think the deadline in the community kind of works for everybody. We now do have professional novelists who, you know, have a book contract to fulfill, and that 30-day deadline, you know, really does help move them. It's helpfully terrifying for everybody.
Yeah, I remember, you know, talking a long time ago with somebody about how do you get all of this accomplished? She was a writer and filmmaker and worked on a lot of the same kind of projects I do. She said, you have to make yourself accountable. You have to have a deadline. And I said, but what if it's a pet project? You know, which a novel to most people is a pet project. It's give yourself a deadline, make yourself accountable. And this is a great way of doing that with a book.
It's very true. And you know, I think, too, there's the website part of it. But then we also have National Novel Writing Month chapters. And these are kind of loose-knit groups of people who actually get together in pretty much, you know, every city and college town in North America and then in other countries as well. To write. And they get together, you know, most nights, again, after work or school, in coffee shops or living rooms and libraries, and you just bring a laptop or a lingual pad and actually just work on your novels. And you're not really chatting or socializing all that much, although you can do that. And that, too, I think builds that accountability, because at that point, you've met these people, and you don't want to be the one person in the group whose word count is severely lagging. So you tend to put a little more time into writing. It's sort of like having a personal trainer at the gym. If you know that there's somebody waiting there for you,
right,
you're much more likely to go.
Right. Now, there's something you called nano-mail to help build that sense of community for people who don't maybe have other support. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's basically just a private messaging system built into our website. So participants can email each other, and it works kind of the same way that email does. And we do have a lot of participants that end up kind of making friends through National Novel Writing Month and carrying on those friendships either kind of as their writing group capacity or just in a social way year-round. And that's been kind of one of the great things about this. In fact, this year we had our 9th National Novel Writing Month marriage and our 2nd National Novel Writing Month child out in the world.
Did you really?
It really is equal parts, I think, literary undertaking and sort of social activity.
Huh, interesting. Now, you said in the beginning you're a nonprofit, and this is a free option. You do, obviously, because you're a nonprofit, survive on donations. And if people want to make donations, I just want to point this out, because you said if you work for a sizable company, chances are good that your employer will match the donation. And some of the contributors to NaNoWriMo include Microsoft, Adobe, Google, IBM, Wells Fargo.
Right, it's true. And we do basically get by on participant donations. So the event is free, and then at the end of the event, we sort of pass the hat. And it's been actually really wonderful over the years to sort of see the generosity of participants, but also to see the generosity of the companies that they work for that, you know, match any donation that they make to us. And, you know, for an event, especially for our Young Writers Program, where, you know, we're providing workbooks and curriculum and lesson plans and buttons and stickers and posters and things like that, you know, all free of charge to these classrooms, it really means the world to have both, you know, individual donors and corporations kind of step up and help pay for all of it.
Mm. Now, one of the questions on your website I saw, a good question, because a lot of people like to work with partners. Can I share writing duties with a partner? And you say no, but...
It's absolutely forbidden.
Like you'd know.
You have to have some rules.
Like you'd know.
Anarchy out there. it's a good question. And we actually do a script writing event in April called Script Frenzy as well. And there you can write with a partner. And I think for us, the idea of writing your own book, I think it helps kind of keep that focus that it oftentimes takes to get through a novel. I think sometimes when you work with a partner, things can start to break down and they're outside of your control and you're sort of waiting for them to get back to you on what the, you know, is the main character going to join the polka band or are they going to rob the bank? And I think because the month is so short, it's somehow just a lot more efficient to just kind of take your own story and kind of use your own voice and sort of see what comes from that.
Well, you'll have to come back next March and remind us about Script Frenzy.
I would love to.
that would be a fun thing. So give us some tips. Of the people who participate and the people who win, the people who actually complete the 50,000, what are some common things that those guys do to make sure they meet that deadline?
Well, I think, you know, a very important one gets to that accountability issue, and that's to let people know that you're doing it. You know, to send out an email before it starts saying, I am writing a 50,000-word novel in November. Please check in on me. Because I think with writing, as you said, since none of us are really making our living from this, it tends to fall to the bottom of our to-do list. And there's all sorts of things, you know, that are on fire in our lives that we have to put out. And so novel writing, unfortunately, gets really kind of a second shift in the same way that maybe learning a foreign language or playing a musical instrument might, where it's just really not something that we have to do. And I think that when you let people know that you are tackling this kind of crazy project, you kind of find out that you develop this sort of world of cheerleaders that, that are really excited about this project, and they really want to help you succeed. And they also will kind of help hold your feet to the fire when you do start to kind of stray and watch TV at night instead of writing your book the way you're supposed to.
Right, right.
And I think another really key a key tip that I would have is to sort of embrace the imperfect nature of first drafts. I mean, I think unfortunately, those of us who have read so many books that have meant so much to us, we sort of get this false sense that those books started out in that sort of gilded, wonderful state that they were when we bought them in the bookstore.
Mm.
And we completely forget and lose track of this idea that those also started out as these, you know, kind of awkward, you know, cliche-filled, you know, sort of monodimensional characters and not such lovely prose, and that really they were built up over time, that it started with a first draft that was then, you know, reworked into a second draft. And novels really are just, they're exquisite, but they're just too complicated to get right on the first go-round. And I think embracing that idea right off the bat that this is kind of an exciting anything-goes draft and you're going to sort of allow tangents and allow yourself to kind of let the story unfold as it goes. And I think when you do that, then you just end up kind of going with the sort of momentum and spirit of the events. You don't quite get caught up in the same way you might on making every sentence perfect. And I think that tends to be the death of a novel, is once you start working on those sentences.
True. That applies for any writer. You need to leave that editor in the closet on that first draft.
Exactly. And I think that what we're saying is editing is absolutely important. You know, you really should just hold off until December. You know, to put that thing, that the inner editor gets locked away in its kennel until December 1st, and then you can retrieve it and kind of have at it.
Mm. I know Ernest Hemingway, I think I can't remember the name of the story now, but he wrote it about 76 or 78 times. He rewrote it. It's, you know, good writing, they say, is rewriting. And he also said this great quote, which I found. He said, I can't say it all because we're on radio, but he said, the first draft of anything is blankety blank.
It's so true. It is really true. And I think that's the kind of common wisdom, too, that you read interviews with novelists, and they kind of say the same thing, that first draft really is, you know, what Ernest Hemingway said. And but, you know, I think there's a real exciting potential in that, because it really does mean that if you aren't supposed to get it exactly right, then you're sort of freed up to take risks and write on the fly and kind of learn by doing and just kind of roll up your sleeves and dive in.
Mm. Now, I looked on the KCLS website, King County Library System website, is very actively involved in this. Tell me how you got involved with them, or how you got them to be involved with you.
Well, so libraries in general tend to, you know, be absolutely wonderful partners for National Novel Writing Month. And I think because there's such a, obviously, a book-focused space, and they're always looking for ways to bring more people into the library. So, you know, throughout the United States even, there are quite a few libraries that actually do kind of sponsor local groups. And sometimes it can be adult groups, sometimes it can be kids and teens. But it's really, you know, the librarians have just been wonderful in sort of creating this safe, encouraging place to write.
Mm. One last thing, let's give out your website. We must give out your website before I forget. Go ahead and do that.
So it's NaNoWriMo.org, which is a little bit, it's kind of a mouthful, but if you just Google National Novel Writing Month, that's probably the safest way to get there.
Yeah, it pops up straight away. And people can just jump on there straight away and sign up?
Absolutely. Just there's a box that says sign up now, and that's what you do. And it's absolutely not too late. It's, you know, November 3rd. You know, we have people who start on November 20th every year and still manage to finish. So there's plenty of time to get that novel written.
Now, since you're organizing this and since it's grown, so I think you said, on the website said you've got over 140,000 participants already this year. Are you writing your novel this month again?
I am every year. I feel like I would somehow not be practicing what I'm preaching if I claimed I was too busy to not write a novel. So I have 5,031 words underway, and I'm enjoying it.
Well, good. Good luck to you. And give out that website again, please.
Oh, it's nanowrimo.org.
Fabulous. Chris Beatty, thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about National Novel Writing Month.
Thank you for having me, Vicky.
Bye-bye. Bye. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. And if you're interested in National Novel Writing Month, just type that in. Google will pop it straight up. Also, check out the events at KCLS. They've got some writers' workshops. They've got some novelists coming along to tell you how you can tighten things up and develop characterization. I know some of the classes are full, but I do know some of those authors. So if you can't get in, drop me an email or give me a call and I'll see what I can do for you. And again, I want to thank you for being with us today. We'll be back next Monday at noon with all new programming. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Does the rat race get you down?
Would you like to opt out or shake things up? Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair on the third Monday of every month to hear about alternative lifestyles and viable career options. Coming November 17th, learn what it takes to build a profitable freelance lifestyle with longtime freelancer Michelle Goodman. Hear about the ups and downs, how you can create your own work hours, how to build a solid reputation, and what you should consider before quitting your day job. Michelle Goodman is a Seattle-based expert who's learned firsthand how to support herself while building a successful freelance business. Join us for Get a Freelance Life, coming Monday, November 17th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.